Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in for another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. I have Jason Burmis on the other end. We've actually been talking, I don't know, it's been all my fault. I first messaged him like 3 or 4 months ago, and I was like, hey, Jason, you going to come on? And he's like, yeah, sure. And I said, how about this day? And then I was like, nope, okay, how about this day? And finally, we worked it out. So it's been all my fault, but glad to have him on. You guys probably know him best from Loose Change. He's done a bunch of different documentaries. He's a very provocative guy. He's got lots of, anti-establishment thoughts out there. But Jason, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So before I put too many words in your mouth, like I just did, I'll just let you describe yourself. Like, how did you get into all this? When did you first start becoming skeptical of everything you were hearing? How did you end up where you are today?
You know, I would say that I've probably been pretty skeptical since I was a kid, right? For instance, I always go to this when we talk about kind of like origin stories, but my dad had this series, Time Life Mysteries. I've actually now got three of them in the other room. I wish they were here next to me so I could hold one up. Basically, it was this, everybody knows time and time life kind of merged at that point. And they were putting out this hardcover read the book series. And it was all these different, you know, mysteries of the universe, UFOs, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, telekinesis, mind control, all this other stuff, right? And at the time, obviously, the internet wasn't around. I'm 42 years old. So we're talking 80s. And once a month, you'd get a new book, right? And for me, kind of growing up, I didn't believe in aliens or UFOs, and I always thought that was just like Star Wars or science fiction. When I found out that there was actually like pictures and video footage and people that believed this was a real thing, I kind of found that fascinating. And at the same time, this was providing pictures on top of it of these UFOs, you know, kind of like the old school ones that, again, things I hadn't seen, and that piqued my interest. I gravitated probably to the more picture-based ones, right? And not so much ghost stories or things like that, but the ones that I thought might be physically true. And kind of at that same time, you had Fox News starting to pump the alien stuff a lot. Alien Autopsy had come out, right? The X-Files also was probably one of the more intriguing series out there. So in that sense, and my opinions on aliens have probably done, a full 180 from what they were when I was a kid and looking at this stuff, by the way. But at the same time, that opened the door for me to look at, you know, black projects. And as I got into my teens, understand MK Ultra. And, you know, while I was in college, you know, yeah, porn was all the rage in the late 90s. You could download pictures and maybe like, a crappy little like video this big pixelated. But for me, it was like, wow, I have access to like, again, not only the MK Ultra documents, but like we were talking UFOs before. The Majestic 12 documents. If people don't know what the Magic 12 documents are, you know, they're told to be forgeries. But again, I wanted to see for myself, right? And this is all pre-9/11. But at this point, it's kind of a hobby, right? It's the mysteries of the universe, okay? You know, all those different things. And I certainly didn't buy into all narratives, but I'll tell you what narrative I did buy into. America. I fucking bought into America, man. I really did. I swear to you, like, you wouldn't believe I bought into America. I specifically remember 1999, and I turned 20 years old at Woodstock, you know, and I was sophomore in college, just getting ready to go into a junior year, good physical shape, ready to take the fucking world by the balls. I thought I was going to be some kind of a, you know, either an animator or a graphic designer or maybe a 3D modeler. That's what I was going to school for, was computer graphics. It was kind of my dream. And it was cool to actually have those tools, because in high school, although I was like an honor society and things like that, I was a poor kid and I really enjoyed art. You know, it was more painting and drawing. But I remember riding around that place and I was just, it was always like, fuck Russia, you can't do this there. And, you know, it was the end of the Soviet Empire that I had been indoctrinated into, right? I grew up Cold War time, so I actually used to do duck and cover drills as a kid. They would take you out in the hallway, and you do the duck and cover. It wasn't under the desk, but that was the big fear. And I'm from the same generation, you know, NASA. They hyped you up, right? Oh, man, we're going here. We went to the moon. Great. But then we all watched the Challenger blow up live. I specifically remember that, too. So for me, I just thought, hey, We're still number one. The economy was booming at the time, too. This is pre-Bush, right? So gas was a buck a gallon or below at that point. The sky was the limit. The internet was booming, man. There was just no reason not to believe in my country, okay? And 9/11 changes it all. Really, that is the moment I go from, you know, just kind of like this traditional Americana kid with this dream of getting really into entertainment, right? Because I'm going to be a graphics guy. I want to be an animator. For instance, in 99, another big year, I went to the SIGGRAPH conference, right? And if people don't know what that is, that's where all these different special effects houses come in, right? So I was sitting there with the guys that had done The Matrix. I went to, you know, there was different levels, but you could go to, like, for instance, Phantom Menace was coming out. So you could go in and watch how they modeled everything and then how you could use ZBrush to paint. You know, these were exciting things for me. 9/11 kind of just, wow. I mean, it just wasn't the same after that. All of a sudden, everything turned. You already kind of had this feel that things were getting weird because you had the Bush-Gore election. Right. And if people don't understand that, that was the hanging chads. It was very apparent that it looked like Bush had stolen the election through Florida, through his brother, Jeb Bush, and, you know, other officials. And I still believe Gore probably won that election. You know, is it potato potato at this point? Would 9/11 happen with Gore? I believe that it would have. But would we have gotten the same kind of like neocon in-house reaction? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I guess there's varying degrees. You can't predict the future, right?
Right.
So I buy into the official narrative pretty early. Okay. I will say on the morning of 9/11, I had questions. I slept through it. I was working late nights at the time. So I think, you know, it happened on Tuesday morning. I think I was up till 4 or 5 in the morning the night before, flipping pizzas and cleaning the shop up. And I was living with fraternity brothers. They were from Long Island. They came in, they wake me up. And I do remember when I went downstairs and the towers were gone, because that's the first thing I remember about everything. My roommate comes in, he goes, "Yo, the Twin Towers are gone." I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, that didn't compute. You know what I'm saying? I'd been in them many times. Every time I went to the city as a kid, I had an aunt that lived, a great aunt that lived in Flatbush, Brooklyn. She lived in like a pretty big high rise for the place. But I specifically, every time I went there, remember looking out the window, and you could always see those towers in Manhattan. And then you'd be next to them and it would be like vertigo. You really couldn't look. I couldn't look up as a kid for too long because you kind of get dizzy almost. It's weird. And it was mind blowing. I remember getting up and getting showered after watching them and saying, you know, it looks like there were bombs in that building. How does that building? I had that initial question. I stopped that question for a long time after, but it didn't seem right to me. And then even walking out of my door, my next door neighbor was screaming, "Yo, fuck Bin Laden and this and that." And I go, "Dude, well, how do you know it was him?" You know, we're talking, it's like maybe noon, maybe noon. We're talking like literally probably less than 3 hours. And he's like, "Well, you know, blah, blah, blah. Who else would be this fucking terrorist?" I go, "Wasn't it like a crazy white guy that did Oklahoma City?" You know, and again, this is when I wasn't questioning those type of things. So, you know, it wasn't until much later. It was actually, you know, you want to talk about the Pentagon. I guess this is a good place to start. One of the first things in my mind where there was a big question about 9/11 and I was kind of disgusted by it was I had become a news junkie from this. Okay. And I don't know, Reed, you're probably what, in your early 20s, late 20s?
27. Yeah.
27. So we had 24-hour news that was starting to come up in the late 90s, right? I think Fox just celebrated their 25th anniversary. And really, they had glommed onto that Clinton-Gore story. And then the net follow-up to that that was a follow-up to Clinton's penis and Lewinsky, right? Those were the big stories of the 24-hour news networks that birthed us, MSNBC and Fox News and all these things. CNN had been around since, you know, the Gulf War. But when 9/11 happened, they turned every network into 24-hour news. There was no television at all for a week, at least. And some went longer than a week, right? So immediately I became a news junkie, right? That was all I was watching, the heightened fear, the new awareness that something was wrong, constantly watching these things. So, you know, it wasn't like I was into Fox flavor by any means, but just it was on. And they talked about a book called Lepentigate. And it was by a guy named, quote unquote, Thierry Masson, right? And it had basically, they were saying that this guy made the case that no plane had hit the Pentagon, right? And my immediate reaction was, fuck that guy and fuck the French, right? Remember, there was a point where we hated the French so much.
Yeah.
Well, we hated the French so much during the War on Terror that we had freedom fries, right? Like that's how absurd things were in this time period. So that was my immediate reaction. I didn't think much about it after that. I thought conspiracy theory, there's no chance, whatever. And then the next thing that kind of hit me, where I gave it more of a consideration, was there was a gentleman on MSNBC, this was pre-Iraq war, talking about how the military's response on 9/11, it was a stand down, basically. Where were the fighter jets? And that, you know, that sounded pretty reasonable, actually. You know, that was something that in my head I was like, you know what, that's a reasonable question. We should probably have that question, especially now that we know that this isn't just Afghanistan, and, you know, it wasn't just we rolled over them. They want Iraq, right? And there was talk of Iran and much more. So that caught my eye. It wasn't until I was in my old high school, okay? So it's probably about like a little less than a year after the attacks. I was in my old high school to go play a men's night basketball game. A couple of my friends had graduated. They'd become teachers, okay? So they were there playing. And while I was there, I went to go take a piss in my old, locker room. And in the urinal, and this was a middle/high school. I graduated with 54 kids, right? Upstate New York, very small. And in the urinal, it said Operation Enduring Freedom, and it was a picture of Bin Laden on the urinal cake. And you could actually look these things up. And I'm sitting there pissing on it, and I'm thinking, man, this is kind of nuts. They got kids pissing on this guy's face. Like, it just something clicked in my brain. You know, that was a big clicking moment, because speaking of, you know, the time when I was a kid, you know, I never pissed on Gorbachev, right? Right. That wasn't a thing. And he was the big enemy and Russia was the big enemy. And I saw the parallels and I'm like, that's a pretty vulgar act. And that's a pretty subliminal act. I've got to make sure that they're telling us the truth about this, because, you know, through all this, I hadn't mentioned the Kennedy assassination, but that was another thing. You know, in the late 90s, I could get Kennedy documents now. It's like, wow, you know, I could watch all these documentaries that were kind of out there. So I came across a site called 911standdown.net and www.911timeline.net first. It's by the same guy. The stand down one, you know, don't get me wrong, it was good afterwards, but 911timeline.net is just 12 a.m. to 12 a.m. of that day. That was the first thing in my brain. I said, all right, let's take a 24-hour look at what happened that day, and are there a lot of problems? And basically, it had this synopsis on how much we spent on defense. It also mentioned how empty the planes were for that morning, which was kind of weird, and a couple other points. But then it went 12 to 12, and there were just so many anomalies, man. That's when I went to standdown.net. That's when I started downloading video. That's when I found stuff on, you know, questioning whether the Pentagon had been hit by a plane or a missile and all these other types of things. You know, for instance, even the first edition of Loose Change that I was not a part of, the pod on the bottom of the plane that hits the second tower, okay, supposedly Flight 175. That was something that, you know, he had had four videos on, and I had actually found a fifth that didn't make the film of, you know, this anomaly that appears to be something that's shot out of the underside of the plane, you know, all these things. So really what blew it over the top for me is the backstory was there, but then there was a lot of other physical evidence. Obviously Building 7 would be there. The no footage at the Pentagon, when you started to look at what was actually going down at Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that you had this 8-mile debris field and they hadn't recovered any bodies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At least according to the coroner, what's his name? Wally Miner at the time. And actually 20 years later, I played the video around the anniversary of 9/11 when he did one of his first interviews since, because he had done flack that he said that he got there and his job, you know, was basically to identify bodies, but there was no bodies to identify. Then, you know, the fact checkers came, the fact checkers of their days, the debunkers, and he kind of repositioned that. And that's, he's like, well, we couldn't find him. But then if you listen to this interview, he says the same thing. He talks about the 8 mile debris field in New Baltimore, and we'll get there. And that's important because it couldn't have just blown there. It was over a mountain ridge. Okay. That means there had to be an event in the air. But then he says they basically just buried all the bodies underneath. That's not normal. he says they bulldozed the bodies and that it's just a mass grave there. That's not normal. Yeah. You know, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, especially, whether or not, no matter what you think happened there, I think there was an event in the air and it was something was blown up in the air. And obviously, we had debris all over the place. I'm extremely skeptical of some of that debris because that's where they get the narrative of the hijackers wearing red bandanas, for instance. Are you aware of this?
I'm aware of this, yeah.
Yeah. So for those that don't know, they actually presented in court, and you can go check out my videos on this, a unscathed folded bandana that somehow survives this plane crash where, again, 15 years later, the FBI, and I played this for Kevin Roos of the New York Times, if anybody wants to see it, to get his response, where all three FBI agents say there was, one of them says there was literally no evidence of a plane there. He goes, I looked to the left and to the right. There was no evidence a plane had crashed there, right? But they have another passport from the hijacker, right? They had a passport from the hijacker in New York City that survived that plane crash into a building. You have an unscathed bandana that somehow they attest was attached to one of the hijacker's heads. It's not burnt. There's no blood on it. There's not a head there. I don't know exactly what happened, but I know that the FBI certainly has manufactured evidence after the fact before and been caught, right? Mm-hmm. And for instance, you know, when we get to 77, Flight 77 and the Pentagon, for instance, you have Khalid Al-Madar as the supposed lead hijacker. Now, Al-Madar has fed prints all over him. Like this guy's living with and renting from FBI informants. But another aspect that I don't think has been delved in to enough with Al-Madar, you know, other than the fact that I believe that you look at the flight data, the fact that they're saying there's no video at the Pentagon, I still think that's absolutely nonsense. Obviously, they have film of whatever hit the Pentagon. That happened, and then Al-Madar was supposed to be part of this other cell. Yet no one talks about the James Woods incident in August of 2001, right before, where he gave court testimony that he was on a plane with Khalid Al-Madar. And I believe the other hijacker he identified, this one I may get wrong, but I'm almost sure it was Nawaf Al-Hamzi, okay? Mm-hmm. And they were not able to identify the other two, but James Woods, the stewardess, and the pilot all filed reports they felt they were doing a dry run hijacking, okay? And this came out during the Dark Overlord documents. It was confirmed, and they named the FBI agent in it. I can't pull that one off the top of my head, but anybody can go watch my video, The Secret Testimony of James Woods, and we go through the document, which is basically James Woods' written testimony, but they have video footage of it, right? It's at these hearings in regards to lawsuits via Huntley, ICTS, even Kroll is kind of a part of it as well. These are the ones involving Silverstein Properties trying to make multiple lawsuits for multiple buildings. And basically three out of the five dumps came out. There's still two dumps that never came out. But this one I thought was very important because Al-Madar should have been nowhere near that plane. Remember, that's the ADA plane. And ADA has kind of been, you know, promoted as the quote unquote lead hijacker. When we talk about the Pentagon in particular, right? I know there's this meme out there that, you know, I'm still saying no plane hit the Pentagon after 14 years or 15 years. I just want to say, number one, that in 2005, when we put out Loose Change Second Edition, and that one definitely went full board missile theory. I didn't really consider much else. You know, we went back and took the profits that we had from that and did our own investigation where we went and we interviewed Bob Pugh in person. For those that don't know who Bob Pugh is, he's the guy that was on the lawn who took all that footage that you saw before the Pentagon's front end collapsed after the strike, right? So we sat down with him. We got all of his raw footage. We interviewed April Gallup. We never put that interview out because April didn't want us to put it out there. But she's the one that literally walked through the hole with her child, of where the Pentagon struck. We went and talked to Lloyd England. We did put that one out there. Lloyd England is the gentleman who drove the cab and one of the telephone poles that came down right through. You know what's funny about that? You know what book he had in his car when that happened?
I don't.
David Icke's Children of the Matrix. He had the lizard person book in the back of his car. That's a real story. And Lloyd England was married to an FBI agent as well. Like his wife was an FBI agent. Always found that interesting.
Before we get, because we've been going on for a long time, I just want to ask you a couple things about Flight 93 because we went over that first.
Sure.
Are you familiar with Flight 1771 that crashed in California in 1987?
If that is the plane that they said a gentleman who was, I believe he was supposedly a disgruntled worker.
Yes, that's the story. Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about that because, you know, again, these people that love to attack me and say there's, you know, I've talked about how there's no time in history that you had the kind of damage, and I will contend to stay with that, that was in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. In other words, 8 Mile debris field, no bodies according to the coroner, all the FBI agents getting there saying they didn't see a plane, then them not finding the bodies at all and basically bulldozing the bodies. That is not what happened in this case. Let me say this. For those that don't know about that, I think that the contention was that they had one eyewitness come out and say, because I've seen the clip, say that basically there was no evidence a plane had crashed there, right? And it was in little confetti pieces everywhere. Mm-hmm. One person, okay? I have, in the Loose Change series alone, at least 5-10 people saying that, right? And then now I have the FBI agents saying that 15 years later when they put out their own report. And by the way, I would encourage people to go watch that raw video because everybody knows that they say that that's the let's roll moment and they went and overtook the cockpit. Do you know where that, what that evidence is? I mean, if I had the time, I'd go find it and play it for you. It's literally this. That's what you hear. You don't hear any voices. You don't hear any attacks. The FBI agent literally has to frame it like what we think is a struggle, but we don't know. Okay. Now with this case, previously, right?
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say, I just watched a documentary about it before this video, and there was a like 7 to 8 mile debris field with Flight 1771.
I am skeptical it was a guy with a gun and a crash. For those that don't know, they actually had to change a law after the fact because there were so many CEOs of large corporations. I believe it was an oil company, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, where they had to change the law. They couldn't travel together in case a disaster like that had happened. So again, with that large of a debris field, with a scenario that they never really proved that it was a man with a gun that went crazy that had inside help apparently to get in, right? To get onto the plane and have that weapons. And by the way, when you talk about 9/11, Time is the first one to put out 9/11 an inside job and talk about how there were weapons planted on those planes.
Well, this guy on Flight 1771, he got fired. And then the same day he went on the plane, he still had all his credentials. Like he didn't have to go through normal security. And they have they got the black box of him say, you know, they hear all the gunshots. They hear him talk to the flight attendant right before he shoots her. And then both of the pilots too. I mean, I don't know how much further you've dug into this.
I mean, exactly. I can't contend to be an expert at all on that. You know, I looked into what I could find pretty briefly. Obviously, I knew the base story of it and kind of the questions. But from
what happens is the documentary that I watched, this guy gets fired because he gets caught on a security camera stealing from, I think it's from the refreshments fund on the airplane. Like it steals cash out of it, but he also has a history of crime. So his boss fires him. And then that same day, he knows the plane that he's going to be on flying to San Francisco. So he goes to his locker, gets his gun, and he gets on the plane. And then he actually writes a letter on, this is also interesting just because of the passport and everything. It's all kind of connected to this, but he writes a letter on an airsick bag to his boss saying, like, It's kind of ironic. We both ended up on this flight. You ruined my day. I'm going to ruin yours. Something like that. He writes it out and he drops it in his lap as he goes by. And then he goes into the bathroom, comes out with his gun, and then he shoots the boss twice. And then he shoots the pilots and the flight attendant. And then he puts the plane in a nosedive and it crashes at like 700 miles per hour. There's no bodies, no big pieces of the plane anywhere. The guy shows up, the investigator, he shows up and he can't find any bodies anywhere, which was shocking to him. Can't find any pieces of the plane, just paper all over the place. Cause I think it
carried. Yeah, I saw the one investigator say that part of it, mm-hmm. but again, I didn't watch the whole documentary. That's one person.
When sure. I'd recommend the whole documentary. Yeah, yeah. Very yeah. interesting.
So. I'd certainly look at it. But again, when you know, I saw the circumstances of that. And look, I have no idea what this guy's history it is. Maybe that is what happened. But mm-hmm. when you have that large of a debris field, I mean, and again, there was no mountain ridge to go over there. I believe it crashed into like nosedived into a mountainous area, correct?
Correct.
Correct, yes. So it was already at a high elevation there. Right. So higher elevation, probably a bigger spread down. You know, when you're talking about, again, a field that is not a mountainous region and mm-hmm. somehow it goes 8 miles in the other direction over a mountainous region, I think that's a problem. And that debris is indisputable. And it's something the debunkers never want to talk about. Okay. I know that some have talked about it after the fact. But they, you know, the official like popular mechanics people, right? They just sure. say Indian Lake. They don't even acknowledge that it was in New Baltimore. So here's my problem. It's like the same thing with the controlled demolition stuff, right? And especially with one and two. They won't acknowledge that Peter Bukarski, the head of FEMA in New York on September 16th, said that there was temperatures of 2,700 degrees, right? Instead, the debunking point is, oh, these guys say jet fuel doesn't melt steel beams, but it doesn't have to. It just has to weaken them, and they weaken at 1,500 degrees. In other words, we're not going to acknowledge there were any temperatures of 2,700 degrees debunked. That's how I feel about it. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, but at the same time, like, it seems like the goalposts shift because, like, there's no other the claim that a lot of people make is there's no other time in history where a plane has crashed and you can't find large pieces of the plane. You can't find bodies.
There isn't. And yep. Listen, again, if we're talking about a mountain range, okay. If we're talking about a mountain range, we're talking about rock, number one. We're mm-hmm. not talking about soft soil, correct? This was
yeah, an when you're going, field. When you're going,
we're talking about two different things. And secondly, again, and I haven't done a ton of, I mean, if I've got to dig into this one, I guess I will. But what I've seen one eyewitness say that one, it wasn't the newscaster on the scene. It wasn't the coroner. It wasn't the entire FBI team that was sent there. All right. All I'm saying is that maybe that's the case, but I know that's the case here in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, no doubt about it. And as far as bodies there, I don't know what they did with those bodies or how they identified those bodies in that other situation. But here, they had very little pieces. And again, they bulldozed a field with supposed bodies underneath it. Again, not something they did not do, as far as I know, in this other case. But again, I haven't studied it. So yes, there is no other plane crash in history like this one. I will say that over and over again, period.
Okay. I'm just saying there is one where there are no bodies found, no large.
According to one person, Reed.
No. There's. You got to watch the documentary. Like
right, I will watch the documentary. I'll send it to you. And I will totally watch it.
All right, but the other thing that's interesting, and I don't like with the bandana thing. I don't like. I think that's a little sketchy too, especially if it was around someone's head. If it wasn't around their head. I think it's a little different, you know, that, we don't know if it was someone was actually wearing it or if it was just on the plane. Like, you know, when one thing smells fishy to throw it all out because you don't know if that was an extra bandana they had or if it was some other passenger's bandana. You just don't know. So just for them to claim it was around the hijacker's head is kind of weird, but also to say like that disproves the whole story, I also think is weird. But with the, you know, with IDs and passports and things like that. With this plane crash that I'm talking about, 1771, paper is what survives. Like, sure, anything heavy is pulverized because they're going so fast. You know, all the light material gets blown out into the air and floats around. So, you know, like, finding IDs on the ground, although it sounds ridiculous at first, it's really not.
Well, I don't think all IDs. Let me make sure that I kind of give this a caveat. I'm saying that they're, you know, they have another, they're just so lucky that they get another passport from the hijackers on that scene. And the absurd one to me would obviously be the World Trade Center, where you would think that absolutely nothing could have survived that, and matching that up. When you talk about IDs, for instance, you know, I don't think that CC Lyles somehow survived the situation. And I know that her ID is on the scene there. You know what I mean? I've looked at a lot of the evidence, and that's my point. What is genuine and what isn't? We do know that papers obviously survived from that. That's the majority of what was found in New Baltimore. But, you know, when you talk about the Indian Lake sites and beyond, you know, there's a lot more substantial stuff that they say that was found in those areas in a 2 to 3 mile radius.
If the plane had been shot down or blown up or something, to me, that would seem surprising that there wouldn't be large pieces of the plane. Because when a plane gets shot out of the sky, or if it just randomly crashes, or especially if it's trying to land, then you have like large pieces of the wings, the fuselage all over the place. The only other time that I've seen in history when a plane is like so indistinguishable and gone is when it was intentionally driven into something, which is so rare. We almost never see that happen. So in the rare case that it does, it seems like this actually points to that it was rammed into the ground as hard as it possibly could be. I mean, if it was shot out of the sky, you don't think.
First of all, I didn't even say it was shot out of the sky. Let me make sure that we get there. Okay. I think it was an air event. You know, one of the things that's almost never considered is, could it have been blown up with explosives inside, you know, whatever it was. If you remember, the hijackers all said they had bombs, right? We have a bomb on board. Everybody stay calm. I'm not saying that's the case either. What I'm saying is it looks like an air event to me. The shock wave that went, you know, 15 miles that, you know, one individual, I think it must have been 10 years, maybe a little bit more than 10 years after. And it's one of the only videos of the cloud that happens after the event. We had that picture for the longest time, right? But in that video, I think I played it when I was doing the Shanksville piece around the, what is it now? On the 20th anniversary of 9/11. You know, he talked about that shockwave. The event looks like in the sky for me, you know, and again.
So this is my question. If it was blown up in the sky, wouldn't you find big pieces of the wings and the fuselage? I mean, that's why it seems like it was. Because honestly, Jason, like, before I ever, Ryan Dawson got me into 9/11 truth or whatever. But before that, like, I bought the official narrative. The thing I was skeptical about was the Flight 93 story. I was like, this sounds like propaganda, you know, to make us all feel good about America or whatever. So I was totally there. Like, I was totally questioning Flight 93, that they didn't shoot it down or that it wasn't blown up or something. The only reason I believe that, or not the only reason, but the biggest reason I believe it was driven into the ground, is because there's like almost nothing left of this, such small fragments of it. If it had been blown up in midair, I feel like you would be finding all these big pieces all over the place. Because that's, you know, I mean, like, even in Loose Change, they were talking about the plane that got bombed. Like, those were examples of images they were using. The planes that got bombed in midair, there were large pieces of the fuselage all over the place. The only time you see the plane basically vaporized is when, you know, it's driven right into the ground like that.
Look, Reed, I'm going to say it again. I don't believe that. And I also am not so sure that that's Flight 93 that exploded up there. I think, I want to say this. I think all those people involved in the, you know, four official planes that were hijacked that day, right? Because we also had many, many quote unquote phantoms that day. They found weapons on other planes. You had the United, I believe, 52 incident, where people actually got on the plane and then left. And they had the exact same types of luggage that didn't make it on Flight 11 that was attributed to ATA. Right. We're talking about these types of manufactured evidence. And then I'll clearly say it. I still believe that the video evidence show, to me, strongly shows that whatever hit towers one and two were not flight 11 and 175, period. I do believe drones were used. I think real hijackings happened. I think that's where the evidence points. I think that, for instance, when you have that first report of gunshots on, I believe it's flight 11. Are you aware of that?
No, not off the top of my head. I've probably read it, but yeah.
So again, with the Dark Overlord documents, one of the things that came out were the drafts for the 9/11 commission report. And finally, in this draft, the reports of the gunshot make the draft, and then who they were reported to for the first time, I believe it was Eric something or other, but the first time I read which official got that call. Now, the question is, were there guns on these planes? I don't necessarily believe that it was box cutters used by these people. The Time magazine article called Inside Job says that there were other weapons found on other planes, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
you know, you had the drills going on, not only that day, but prior, right? Amalgam Virgo would be a great example of that, where they took a commercial jet and they were going to fly it into what was, I believe, the Capitol, not the White House, right? I'm pretty sure it was the Capitol, not the White House. It was on the cover. But during that red and blue war game, you also had UAVs and you had other types of attack. You actually had, I believe there were surface-to-air missiles there as well. So you had all this chaos going on. You know that the war games were going on throughout the day. Okay. Again, one of the great, you know, debunker claims is that all these drills stopped as soon as that first plane hit the World Trade Center. That's not the case. If you go into the NORAD tapes, which we were like the first people to get after Vanity Fair, right? I remember Vanity Fair did a piece on them. We got it. It was clear that they continued to call into Cheyenne Mountain, the underground base where people are extremely isolated, and have them take the Phantoms off. And that continued up to 20 minutes. It was 20 minutes after Flight 93 had supposedly crashed that that happened, right? And then we see all the attacks cut off. So to me, you know that you had Phantoms, okay? Mm-hmm. You know that they had used UAVs and Amalgam Virgo that was so many like these other other drills, Vigilant Guardian, Northern Guardian, Northern Vigilance, etc. You know they were running apocalypse drills that day because you have the E-4Bs themselves, not only at the scene of the Pentagon right after the attack, but at the scene of the World Trade Center, clearly an E-4B is in the air before the second plane strikes, all right? I don't contend to know exact. I mean, we do. We're 42 minutes into this, and we've talked about a lot of physical anomalies and drills and things like that. But for me, you know, everybody always asks me at the end of the day, well, what do you think happened, right? Uh-huh. And the best answers I tell people is I think that this was an international intelligence operation with role players in Saudi Arabia. That's where you kind of got the funding and the fronting of getting a lot of these guys over. They were able to use their embassy to bring them over as Central Intelligence Agency assets. You had the Pakistani ISI angle of that, right? So then you could funnel some of this money with our allied network that was kind of Mujahideen, Osama bin Laden, anti-Soviet from the late 70s, early 80s spillover, right? And that's basically General Mehmed, General Mehmed, why am I killing this? Who is it? Mehmed Ahmed? It's killing me.
Yeah.
The head of the Pakistani ISI wires out $100,000 just before the attacks. It's in D.C. on the morning of the attacks, meeting with all the key players, including Joe Biden, by the way. Met with him on, I believe it was 3 days after September 14th. Biden gets on TV and brags about it, right? His right-hand man, has now been released and is in a safe house over in the UK, right? This is, man, I'm usually killing with names and I'm not doing a great job. Omar Saeed Sheikh. Okay, Omar Saeed Sheikh is the guy that they blame the Daniel Pearl murder on. He's the guy that Benazir Bhutto says murdered bin Laden before she herself is assassinated as she tries to run for the head of India, right? So you have the Pakistani angle, obviously funding these guys and involved in some kind of intelligence work. Or why is he there meeting with all these officials as the war on terror is about to kick off? So you got Saudi Arabia, you got Pakistan. Now you have Israel. Okay. And in, you know, Fabled Enemies, especially, you talk about this ground level network that is throughout the United States pre 9/11, Okay. And it's not just art students, but art students is a big part of that, right? You also had people who were in mall kiosks, for instance, and they were doing like the helicopter thing, but they had infiltrated all these different, you know, official and unofficial intelligence operations, right? If you go down the list of what Fox News exposed in January, it was all over the place. And then, of course, you have people being picked up prior to 9/11, the dancing Israelis, but then also the King Street incident that a lot of people don't talk about. You know, they talk about the first van, but they have a van that exploded on King Street, and we put that in Fabled Enemies as well, which gives you the idea that these guys weren't just there to record the event, but were also part of the operations on the ground, in my opinion.
So I just got a question. I don't want the whole episode to take up 9/11 because just for people who are watching right now, like Jason and I have been talking for months. The 9/11 thing has just come up in like the last few weeks, become big with me. So I don't want it to all be, but I just have one question, which is about the hijackers. Like, what was the purpose of the hijackers? Because all the links that we see, like through the Israeli Mossad with Ziad Jarrah or with Al-Midar and Al-Hazmi through Saudi Arabia, if they weren't there to hijack planes, like what's the point? How do you have a Saudi link without them? How do you have an Israeli link without Ziad Jarrah? And especially with Ziad Jarrah, it's really interesting because the phone calls, you know, they talk about three hijackers, all dark-skinned males, which Ziad Jarrah was not dark-skinned. I don't personally believe he was on Flight 93. I think he was probably an Israeli mole. But what is the point of all these people who are being funded and all their connections if they're not hijacking planes and flying them into buildings? Why are they even there in the first place?
I think they are hijacking planes and drilling that, right? I would assume the vast majority of those 19 probably were just kind of going along to get along. In other words, unknowing assets. They actually maybe believed in their jihad, et cetera. But a very select few knew exactly what they were doing, and they were running intelligence operations. You look at Atta, for instance, right? And you look at have you seen the Venice Flying Circus and Daniel Hopsicker's research with Rudy Deckers and the flight schools down there? I would definitely point people towards that because, you know, Otto wasn't some kind of, you know, Muslim purist. He was a coke dealer, you know, dating strippers, right? And there's even some talk that maybe he was doing that on Jack Abramoff's riverboat casinos as well. So I think at one level, you kind of have these assets that do the dirty work, the black ops of the CIA, right? And other intel networks. They are running drugs. They are the heads of actual terror networks. And I think that obviously hijackings took place that day. I really do believe that. As to whether or not those are the planes that actually go into the buildings, I don't think they are. I think that's the cover to make sure that they get what's done. I think all those people are dead. You know, whether or not, for instance, you do listen to some of those audio inside those planes, right? We do have audio. We do have black box. We have some phone calls that do seem to be legitimate that weren't cell phone calls that were from air phones. And, you know, you have talks of the stabbings, right? You also have talks of what seems to be a gas and not being able to breathe inside. You know, all these things do seem to be taking place. I think it's an overlap, right? Like, for instance, Abel Danger is identifying and following these guys for some time, but yet they don't use any of the actionable intelligence to stop them. It's the same thing with, you know, how did Atta and the boys get to hijack what becomes Flight 11 when Flight 11 was just cased by Khalid Al-Madar and Nawaf Al-Zahami and the FBI knows about it? I mean, think about that for a second, right? We're pre-9/11, a Hollywood actor, the pilot, and the stewardess all file reports. We know they got filed and nothing was done. We know that Waleed Al-Shaari, for instance, Reed, had the CIA called on him. You know, Diane Albrighton thought the stuff that was going on next to her house was so shady, she called the Central Intelligence Agency and nothing was done. You know, I think assets.
I just got one question real quick. Sure. So do you think, because all these guys, you know, they weren't great pilots. The whole idea was, you know, the pilots are going to get them off the ground for us and then we can just fly them into the targets.
Sure.
So Did they just crash them somewhere, or was there a CIA pilot planted on the plane so they could land them and then kill all
or
the
passengers? Or do you even need a person to do that with Global Hawk technology? You know, Global Hawk technology was around in the 90s and fitted in a lot of commercial aircrafts. It's one of the things that's never really talked about. So you could remotely hijack a plane. In fact, it was put in there to stop hijackings from planes and discourage hijackers from doing so, because even if you did take manual control, it could be overridden. You know, I think, again, I'll say it again. I think the evidence of the planes that hit the World Trade Centers, they look like drones to me. You know, that flash, even in that first video, does not, you know, it looks reminiscent of that second flash. I know that's not popular. I know it's not something we even put in the second edition of Loose Change, etc. But I've seen it again and again and again. I think that apparatus is on the bottom. I think that's a gray plane. I think that you had a multitude of things going on there. I think actual hijackings happened. Again, the doomsday planes in there, who knows what kind of technology that is? An E-4B is a remote command center with the continuity of government on it. Okay? And you're telling me there's nothing fishy when you have video of it at the scene of two of the crimes? The scene of two of the crimes. It's at the Pentagon and it's at the World Trade Center. So, again, without the proper investigative tools, right, other than what we have open source via testimony, news, documentation, I can't subpoena somebody, right? Like I went on, Conspiracy Social Club. I ended up doing two episodes with Brian Callen and Sam Tripoli. And at the end of it, you know, Callen asked me, he goes, well, who do you think did it? And I go, I don't know exactly who did it. I don't have the power of subpoena. I can't investigate these people. I can't pull documents and then cross-examine and do all these things. I have to do that with the available evidence. But, you know, the available evidence to me is, you know, you have this Saudi, Pakistani, Israeli continuity government, aka shadow government operation here. I think that's the only way you make it happen. You need all those different tools. And obviously you need a complicit media, right? And a complicit alliance in the United Nations. And that kind of goes along with all these different things. Sure, you have interests. I mean, you look at, for instance, the Saudi.
I know you don't really know my position, but I agree with you on a lot of the motives there. Like, I do not think that the terrorists hated us for our freedoms and just decided to hijack planes and fly them into targets, and that they had no help and that it wasn't exploited. And, you know, I think there's proof that Saudi Arabia definitely helped them. And then Pakistan and Israel also probably did too. So I'm not like this establishment shill who like hates anyone questioning anything.
No, I don't think you are. I don't think that's it at all. I don't think you can point to one group and say, you know, I know it all. And I know there are those
people that definitely don't claim that.
But I see that a lot where you have to take my position. Look, I've always been willing to say, hey, maybe I got this wrong, right? For instance, let's talk about the Pentagon for a second. You know, if you look at what we did in Loose Change Final Cut, we, again, went more towards the direction that nothing should have hit the Pentagon. And we went into heavily the Norman Mineta testimony, who was the transportation secretary. For those that don't know, he claimed on several occasions, including in front of the 9/11 commission, that he was in the Presidential Emergency Operating Center with Dick Cheney prior to the Pentagon strike, right?
Right.
And he also made the claim that, you know, there was a young man in the room and he said the plane's
50 miles out, 10 miles out.
Exactly. And, you know, I had always contended that it really looked like Dick Cheney was in there and that Norman Mineta had told the truth. Now, in 2016, so this is now 5 years ago, there were photographs released from inside the White House that I believe were from a Canon 16 millimeter. Again, if you believe what the government puts out. Now, I'm a Photoshop guy, right? And I know about metadata, and I looked at these things and they looked very good, right? Very, very good. They looked very legitimate. The moral of this story is I went through a bunch of them and there are a couple pictures of Scooter Libby and Cheney in his office, right? And you can see where the TV is on. And you got to zoom in, but you timestamp where's on that TV. And there's a possibility Mineta got it wrong. Maybe Cheney wasn't in the PEOC before the Pentagon strike. Maybe that is being truthful. You know, I can't tell you 100%, but I can tell you that that made me question whether or not Mineta's testimony is real. And I'm willing to eat that. You know what I mean? I'm not here, you know, to say I'm right all the time and then deny when I'm wrong. I want to know that I'm right, right? I want to look at the evidence and say, hey, this is evidence-based. So if I got that wrong, you know, I'll cop to it. I'd like to see more evidence on it. I think it was a crime that, for instance, Bush and Cheney got to testify together before the 9/11 commission with no record of the conversation whatsoever. That's absolutely absurd. But, you know, again, it's one of those things where, you know, I could peel back the layers of 9/11 for hours upon hours upon hours and half. You know, I try to stick to with what I can prove. And when I speculate, as I've done a lot here tonight, I explain why and I explain the speculation.
Yeah. Let me just put it this way. What do you think of I'm going to throw a name out there. What do you think of Alex Jones and a lot of his fervent followers who, in my mind, instead of questioning things, they come up with their own thing. And it's just as baseless as believing the establishment narrative. You know, you start building this world that you want to see. And when you want to see something, you just will see it no matter what. Like if you want to start thinking of something, you'll start connecting dots. Do you think that there's a danger in just being contrarian and just, you know, assuming that everything the government says is a lie? Because, I mean, I'm a libertarian, so I don't trust the government at all. But I think that there's truth mixed with lies all the time. And that you know, that's pretty much how anyone does anything. They actually probably want to sell what is as close to the truth as they can with still getting their way because there's going to be fewer holes in it. Do you think there's a danger of just like creating narratives with just as little evidence and, you know, just rejecting everything you hear, because then you're still allowing the establishment to create your narrative and basically decide what's true or not. If you hear something the establishment says and you just instantly chuck it out the window, then you're no different than someone who's like, trust the science, you know, wear your mask, who's just like still listening to everything Fauci says. You know what I'm saying? What do you think about
that? You know, I would agree with the last part of that. Like, you can't just throw everything out and just be contrarian to be contrarian. I totally agree with that. I would say, though, you know, at the part where you were saying they want to tell as much truth as possible to kind of mix their lies in, not at this point. I mean, I've seen so much of an inversion of reality, especially over the last 18 months. I think it's been overhauled. I still think, obviously, you know, we do get things that slip out, right, all the time. And that this is what I call it. I call it whispered truth, right? Because the vast majority of what I do and put out there is somewhere in a mainstream publication, or it is a white paper put out by a think tank or a government organization, or it's an excerpt of an interview from an individual, you know, stating this or that. Let me give you an example. I've been heavy on NASA being a front for the military-industrial complex. That is what they are. I want to make that extremely clear to people. We're not going to the moon. We're not going to Mars. We're not colonizing anything. They're weaponizing space 2.0/3.0 and selling it with you on propaganda. Even these billionaires going to space is a joke. They're not going to space. Okay, they're going 65,000 feet into the air, not even into low Earth orbit. Inspiration 4 supposedly did just go into low Earth orbit. But what that really is selling you on the militarization of everything. And that's what NASA is. So there's a guy named Dennis Bushnell, and he's currently the chief scientist at NASA and has been for decades. Okay. And I have this lecture that he gives, and basically he starts talking about code words, right? And the first code word is sustainability. And during this, he basically lets you know that it's Malthus 101. And if people aren't familiar with Malthusianism, that's the value of a life, right? So, you know, he does go with a lot of truth, but then he gets to, oh, and we might institute some population control, code word sustainability. Mm-hmm. Now, then he goes to the next code word, and it's productivity. And basically he says this is a code word for the ever more automation of society and basically, you know, getting rid of humans in the workforce and the end of the growth industry. Now, they're going to sell you on that being the best thing since breakfast, right? Because that's going to make them profits, et cetera. And there is some truth that it is going to make some people profits, and robots are probably going to be more efficient than humans at many jobs, right? But what's the end design? What's the end goal of that? You know, is it DARPA dogs with sniper rifles on the top of it? So, you know, to bring, you know, I know you brought Jones into it in the beginning, right? And I first of all, I always like to say this. I'm responsible for me, right? And what I do and what I talk about.
By the way, I was not equating you to Alex Jones.
No, I get that part. But like the idea that even, you know, you have these cult of personalities, and you know, Jones obviously has a large following, is extremely famous at this point. I don't agree with everything Alex Jones. I didn't agree with everything Alex Jones said when I worked for Alex Jones, right? It's funny because I just put up a 2 hour plus clip exclusively for my premium members at Rockfin from our second money bomb. It's 6/11/2009. So we're talking now, that's what, 12 and a half years ago, something like that, like well over a decade ago. And there's some points where we're nailing it, you know what I mean? And maybe some points we're jumping the gun. For instance, there's a point where we're talking about WHO pandemic level 6. And this is the 2009 swine flu scare. And we're talking about the United Nations coming in. And a lot of the things we hit on are almost a mirror image of what you see today, right? But at the same time, when Jones is talking about it, he says, this is going down in the next 6 to 18 months, you know? And obviously, it didn't go down in the next 6 to 18 months. But was it somewhat prophetic to where we are today? Hey, go make your own decision. You can go watch it now. Now, on the flip side of that and the danger of that, I think that the QAnon sense thing is one of the biggest dangers that we saw come to fruition. And one of the things that I was extremely vocal against from the very beginning, because not only was it people seeing the world that they thought they wanted to see it because they'd been exposed to, hey, wait a minute, that Epstein thing is real, right? There are high level pedophiles. That is right. Right. But then it's, oh, we got you, Hanks. We got you, you motherfucker. You know what I mean? And it's, well, you know, John McCain's not a good guy. And he actually did go into some of the meetings with the quote unquote rebels that would later turn into ISIS. And this is a fact too. Right. He's in fucking Gitmo. Gitmo's the best thing. We're gonna fucking kill him. And we've got secret indictments and the fucking super secret squirrel force is going to come save us. Yeah, it makes you inactive. It makes you less reliable with your information. It makes you easy to debunk. You know, I've always said that there are no heroes out there other than you in the mirror, right? And you've got to organize with those other people that want to look in the mirror and be their own hero if you want to push back against the system. That's the way to do it. But when you have these narratives, all of a sudden, for instance, the other narrative that I heard again and again that just killed me during that thing is that, you know, Julian Assange was A-OK and they'd already taken care of him. And, you know, Trump was going to pardon him and all stuff, you know, look, and it sucks because I got to watch South Park where they got Oprah Winfrey in a robe with Tom Hanks doing blood rituals. And meanwhile, you know, Reed, in the other room, I have 8 out of the 10 Bohemian Grove annals that are real, where they are wearing robes and doing crazy rituals, right? It might not be baby sacrifice, but, you know, Oprah is part of the good guys club, which is her, Bloomberg, Turner, Soros. You know, you can't say George Soros, Bill Gates, and David Rockefeller Jr. was in there as well at the time. And these guys, you know, are talking about population control openly. So instead of going with that and explaining that, now I have this cartoon narrative of Oprah in a robe drinking child's blood, right? I think that's the dangers of it. And then they take that and they hype that up to, you know, make what was essentially, don't get me wrong, there was some violence, but it felt a lot like a Dave Matthews Band concert up at the Capitol. I was there. I was on the second level.
We're in complete agreement on this issue.
So. Well, I mean, into this, you know, this idea that it was some kind of violent insurrection. I can promise everybody that if it was a violent insurrection, I would have not been there with my camera filming. I would have had my fucking heads up. I might not even been in the situation, right? I'm pretty self-aware guy. And when I feel a real situation of danger, I leave, right? I leave. I get out of that situation. I never felt that there. You know, the one moment where, and you can hear it in my voice, that I'm like kind of worried is up on the second level, and they were going through like the middle, and there was like a barrage of cops there, and they were fighting people, right? And you've seen some of those videos. It's the guys that are trying to dive into the hole and kick at the cops. All of a sudden, a sledgehammer comes out of nowhere, Reed, and it starts getting passed up towards that thing. And I'm literally, and it's a long one. You know, it's not like one, it's a sledgehammer. Mm-hmm. And I go, you can hear me on the video. I go, Jesus Christ. I go, you'll kill somebody with that. I'm like, no, you know, and you see it go up forward. And then you see somebody see, hey, this is a sledgehammer. This is going to kill somebody. They grab it and then they hand it to the police officer. You know what I mean? Who was passing up a sledgehammer and why? You know, that's my bigger question when I'm in that environment. Right. I see that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So look, man, everything comes with, you know, kind of the risks and benefits. And I'm a free speech guy. I'm a free speech absolutist. Even people I think that are repulsive, that I completely disagree with, I think they should be able to talk. I've never, ever advocated anybody be deplatformed from anything. And I've never, ever advocated that we should have laws based on speech, ever. I think that's dangerous. You know, is Alex Jones perfect? Absolutely not. I mean, in the last interview I did with him, you know, he's kind of tired until I, you know, said something about us not agreeing all the time. And then, oh, what don't we agree with, Mermis? And then, you know, all of a sudden I bring up Bill Barr and we have a back and forth about, you know, the Trump administration. I want those open dialogues. I can't say, you know, enough about the fact that, you know, Jones was a pioneer who came out of, you know, cable access. He came out of cable access, right? No one does that. Came out of cable access, built his own empire, and really he mentored me. Would I be in like this talk radio or doing the streaming game that you see now without Alex Jones? You know, I don't know that I would. You know, I love documentary films, but is that sustainable? You know, right now, even with YouTube banning me and all the censorship, I've had one of my best years. I wouldn't have been able to move. You know, we didn't get to talk about it. We kind of preview talked about it, and we've gone a little over an hour, so I do got to get going.
Yeah, soon. Yeah.
And I'm gonna post this over on my Rockfin as well. But in the pre thing, you know, we talked about the Ghislaine Maxwell thing, right? Like, would I have been able to, you know, would I be on that road where all of a sudden I'm at Ghislaine Maxwell's hideout with the Jackman boys, you know, if for Alex Jones, those guys, you know, student scholars for 9/11 Truth, Justin Martell and the Jackman boys, you know, I had them on my Info Warrior show. I'm the first guy he ever gave a show to. But again, you know, I left there because I wanted to be more independent and I wanted to keep making movies, made a film called Shade the Motion Picture afterwards. I, you know, the Sandy Hook thing, there's something me and Jones disagreed heavily on. And, you know, yeah. I've taken him to task for that as well. You know, that's another thing that I've done videos on. I'm sure he's not pleased with. But at the end of the day, you know, here's the deal with Jones. He's going to respect you more if you're true to yourself and you don't just cow down to some narrative, whether he's right about it or wrong, because at the end of the day, you know, he's got respect for Bill Maher even now. And I remember even back in the day, we used to talk about that. He goes, you know, I don't agree with that guy, but at least he sticks by what he says. And he probably truly believes it. He's not just jumping on narratives, you know? Yeah. So as Jones sensationalized stuff, sure. Has he gotten things wrong? Sure. Is there a danger in all of a sudden your narrative becomes one line of thinking? Fuck yes. Fuck yes. But again, that's one of the reasons. You know, for me, I don't watch Fox News on the regular, right? I don't have a program that I catch. I'll tell you what I do. You know, when all of a sudden I'm kind of wondering what's going on in the world, I have this, you know, service where I got like 3,000 channels, and I go to BBC fucking Canada for a second, and I hit CNN over on this international, and I get a flavor of MSNBC, and then I do maybe hit Fox News, but then I'll hit, you know, Newsmax or OAN real quick. And I just kind of want to see what everybody's saying across the world and what the line is. I mean, Reed, you know, I know you watched my video on Colin Powell early this morning, but that was the complete media narrative. Nothing but respect for this, you know, honorary person of the military that was really nothing more than a mouthpiece and a war criminal that was beyond reproach, because if you questioned him, you were a bigot, right? And he sold you on fake weapons of mass destruction, fake chemical plants, the war on terror that's still going on today, et cetera. And that's his true legacy. And that's not for me to take him down as a you know, quote unquote, as a human being, a person. You know, I know there's, I did this show with Fitch today. You know, he said he's burning in hell right now. I'm not going to say that. I'm not his judge. But I'll tell you what, he was sure responsible for a lot of the reasons we're in the messes we are now, for sure. He had his part.
Yeah. Well, hey, man, I know you got to run. I appreciate you coming on. I'm just going to make an open invitation. You don't have to answer right here if you don't want, but I do. I know you and Ryan Dawson have not gotten along in the past, but I do the Four Horsemen show with our mutual friend Eric Jackman and Ryan Dawson. So I am openly inviting you to be a guest on that show in the name of free speech. I think that would be very interesting.
Listen, I have no problem with going on any kind of show. I'll just say this. It's kind of like that meme and the attacking. That's another thing that I really don't do. You know, when I talk about, you know, Jones has a huge platform, and I certainly never attack him or try not to attack him as a person. I'll tell you what, when he told everybody that God had told him to strike down Joe Rogan, it was hard for me not to be like, come on, Jones, give me a fucking break, right?
Yeah.
But I've never been that person. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate when that happens. At the same time, I'm willing to debate anybody on any subject. So perhaps sometime down the line, we'll definitely do that, Reed.
All right, man. Well, quickly, where can people follow you? I got your Twitter and your YouTube in the description, but anything else you got coming up where you want people to go see what you're doing?
Rockfin. You know, that this is what has been supporting me, man. I proselytize for it because I believe in it. You know, one of the things you'll never see me do is go to bat for shit I don't believe in, but they have really empowered me through free speech. It's a live streaming platform. It's awesome. I love it. For $9.99 a month, if you get the premium subscription, you get everybody's shit, you know, and Jimmy Dore's waking up. T-Lab is over there, you know, Ryan Christian doing great work. I think even Max Blumenthal and Michael Tracy coming over there, even more mainline people, right? The Kim Iversons of the world. I want those people over there. And I want, you know, I watch those guys a lot. You know, I don't necessarily agree with them either. I think they're a little bit more of a fresh voice. I'd like to see like Glenn Greenwald over there. We're trying to get InfoWars over there. I think that it's a place that's not stifling free speech, that's growing. And in a time where everything is moving digital, and believe me, there are problems with that, you know, moving into like digital currencies such as this that actually have a purpose, that aren't a fluff coin, Rockfin powered by Ray Token, are also the future. And it's not just, you know, you look at Mines or you look at Odyssey and they're great. Don't get me wrong, but they don't have a mechanism where real money is exchanged through a credit card that again, turns this into, you know, that token that these creators are paid for. So it's a really merit-based system, which is incredible. And it's allowed me to move a vast majority of my audience over. I have almost 40,000 followers on Rockfin, and that's where you're going to find my best stuff, my uncensored stuff, and then some extras that you won't have to hunt down if you are a premium member. So, Reed, once again, I thank you, brother, and I'll see you on the flip side.
All right. Thank you, Jason.